This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things you are going to have a hard time trying to fathom as we listen to their stories. It really is incredible, the things we hear and the things we learn on this program. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us. We want to honor their service, the sacrifices they made. We want to hold on to their stories so the price that's been paid for our freedom is not forgotten. And along the way, like I said, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, sometimes inspired by these stories from men and women from our greatest generation. And we're going to meet one of those guys today. We're going to hear about a lady, too, the Lady Lex, the USS Lexington. Maybe you know the history of that ship in World War II. Let's get to know Gordon Scott of Kingsburg, California, almost 92 years old. And your birthday has a lot to do with the story we're going to hear in World War II. I know you signed up on your 18th birthday. So what, you figured you graduated from Kingsburg High School and the only thing to do was join the Navy? There's a lot of water around here, I guess, huh?
Well, I thought of getting into aviation some way, and somebody told me about might be able to get into aviation in the Navy, and I inquired about it, and the rest is a little history. I did get into it, but it took a little longer to get into it than I thought.
Why the interest in flying? Were you reading about Lindbergh or what?
A fellow here by the name of Luther Linda that used to have an air strip just north of Kingsburg on just off of Stroud Avenue here. He had been a pilot in World War II and had planes out of there, and I got to know Luther real well. It's all set residential now. The airstrip is gone and Luther's gone. You can get in aviation. What I was interested in is probably getting eventually into flight school, but when you get out in the fleet and you get involved in a deal there, it's a little harder to get into aviation. I was on a carrier and in the Air Department throughout my career in the USS Lexington. Eventually, I got back to the United States and was stationed at Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they train pilots. I could have probably went to flight school, but had got married and passed it up.
But a lot happened in between. You were in for exactly 6 years, enlisted on your 18th birthday, discharged on your 24th birthday. But when you went in on July of 1940, did you have any idea America was going to be at war in a year and a half?
No, I didn't. When I first got in the Navy, I went to San Diego Naval Training Station and was there in training program for 3 months. For a while, I thought I might have been in the Army. We'd done so much drilling. But they do teach you a lot of things, and not only drilling and marching and various things like that, but they had various schools like firefighting school, and I didn't realize how important firefighting school was for the Navy. Our ship eventually burned up, so it was quite a deal there.
What was your first impression of the Lexington? When did you go aboard that ship?
When I got through after 3 months in Naval Training Station in San Diego, was sent to Long Beach, and we got on a destroyer and sent to Long Beach and was stationed on the USS Arizona. I left from Long Beach and went to Bremerton, Washington Naval Shipyard there. And the Lexington was in there, and after about a month on the USS Arizona, I was transferred to the Lexington, which was very fortunate from what happened to the Arizona.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, whoa, I've heard of that ship. Maybe I visited what's left of that ship as it still sits there in Pearl Harbor with those teardrops of oil bubbling to the surface. Did you know a lot of those who are still on the Arizona?
Well, I didn't know that many. After all, I was only aboard Arizona for about a month. But then I went on the Lexington. I did get to know a few people, and I've never found out what's happened to them. But the Lexington, I got aboard the Lexington and was stationed in what they call V1 Division, which had the after flight deck deal on the carrier. We were there for about a month and left from there and went back to Long Beach. And from there, we went from Long Beach to Pearl Harbor.
And this is all still before anything has happened war-wise. America is not at war. Were there any rumblings that you guys were preparing for something like that?
No, we had done nothing but training, was in and out of Pearl Harbor and flight quarters and training both our crew and the pilots too. We didn't hear anything about war till the national emergency started. There, when we'd go to sea, even after before we were in the war, we'd go to sea and it was just blackout at night and the lights and everything. So they were looking for something, but we really didn't know about anything.
And we've heard a lot over the years about December 7th and what Pearl Harbor was like that day from different vantage points. Maybe you can give us a sense of what it was like around there before all this happened. Was it almost like an adventure for you to be out in that part of the world?
At that time, you didn't realize it was quite a resort deal like it is today. And we were away from home, so it wasn't as luxurious as we thought it might be, but it is a great place.
And I mentioned that date, December 7th, and you might have been there December 7th, but the Lexington shipped out the day before?
Yes, we were anchored just on the left side of Ford Island, which is a Naval Air Station in Pearl Harbor. And we left out on our way to Midway with a load of Marine planes to reinforce Midway. When we heard about the war, or they bombed Pearl Harbor, we turned around and tried to intercept them, and we couldn't find them, and probably very lucky we didn't, because we didn't have a big fleet with us. The original Lexington had 5-inch guns, 4 batteries of 5-inch guns, and 4 turrets. It had originally been built for a battle cruiser. Right after the war started, we went back into the naval shipyard there and took the turrets off and got rid of the 5-inch guns, and they put all in anti-aircraft guns, because that was what it's going to be all about, fighting planes.
And you mentioned when the war started, but I imagine that's a pretty significant memory for you, how you found out you're aboard the Lexington and you just left Pearl Harbor yesterday and now they're bombing Pearl Harbor. How did that news come to your ship?
Well, of course, it was transmitted by radio to the ship, and they announced it on the loudspeaker and sounded general quarters. From there, they had bringing up all the ammunition and everything for all the gun turrets and the 5-inch guns and whatever. We tried to find the Japanese fleet, but it was very fortunate we didn't, because they probably could have blown us out of the water. So we steamed around and never did find where they came from or anything. And we turned around after 3 or 4 days, came back into Pearl Harbor, and it was just, we just couldn't believe it. The USS Utah, which is an old battleship that had retired and they were just using it for training purposes, had taken our berth on Ford Island. And you don't hear anything about the USS Utah, but it's still underwater alongside Ford Island right now. They literally blew it up and had thought that we would be there. They knew every ship that was there. The only mistake I think the Japanese made, right above at the Pearl City there, up on the hill was Red Hill. All of the fuel for all of the ships and everything were in big tanks there. If they'd have bombed those, we would have had to come clear back to the mainland United States. They didn't touch them. That was a big mistake they made.
Yeah, and a big what if. And you've got a few of those. What if you had remained on the Arizona? You wouldn't be here. And as you said, the Utah, which along with the Arizona, the Oklahoma, was taken out that day, it was in your spot. So that's another what if you had still been there?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, couldn't believe it. The Utah is still underwater there. They never have done anything about it.
And I want to discuss a little more of that scene that you saw when you sailed back into Pearl, but you mentioned going to general quarters on your ship, the Lexington. What did that mean for you personally? What was your duty station at that point?
We were up on the flight deck, and of course, we didn't launch any planes. We were scouting around trying to find the Japanese fleet, too. And we had search planes up, landed them back aboard, but we just couldn't believe it.
And when you did roll back into Pearl, and you mentioned the Utah being in your spot, but most of us weren't there, and maybe we've seen some grainy film or we've seen some black and white photos, but you saw it in living color that day. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
We just couldn't believe it. It was almost sick. Oil on the water and the ships, they weren't burning then, but, I mean, sunk the battleship. There's what we call Battleship Row on one side of the island was the opposite side where the carriers used to anchor, which was very, very fortunate. The whole time I was in there from when I first got to Hawaii and Pearl Harbor, I don't believe I ever seen that there wasn't a carrier in port. And it's really amazing that the Saratoga at that point was back in the mainland in the United States. And I keep referring to the United States because Hawaii wasn't in the United States at that time. It just was unbelievable to see the destruction. The ships underwater and everything, and I forget how long it took we refueled, reprovisioned, and we left out of there. And we never came back 90 days at sea without touching port. And we never did find the Japanese.
Well, you guys would have a pretty impressive encounter with them in late February. But I want to get a taste for what it was like aboard the Lexington, because we've maybe seen the posters with the tattered flag and Remember Pearl Harbor, or we've seen, of course, the legendary song Remember Pearl Harbor. But is it too melodramatic to say that was a rallying cry aboard your ship? What was the impact on morale, on motivation, on what that did for you guys to have seen that devastation and to know that now your country is at war?
First of all, it was hard to believe. Even though we had been training for war, really, and all the time prior to December the 7th, we'd be in and out of Pearl Harbor. We'd alternate with ships. Between the three main deals, the Enterprise, and the Yorktown, and the Lexington, there was always someone in port. It wasn't a coincidence that no ship or carriers were in there. All the battleships were. But it was just kind of hard for us to believe. And the devastation was just unbelievable.
How did that leave you guys feeling about the future, or about the Japanese, or about the task that you had at hand now?
We knew that's what we were there for. We were all over the Pacific trying to find the Japanese fleet or whatever, maybe trying to make them think we had more than we did, but I'm sure that they knew we didn't have more. Then on February the 20th, we were going to try to make a strike on the Japanese in Rabaul. And Rabaul is quite a bit above the Guadalcanal, east side of Guadalcanal, further up in there. And we were going in there and try to bomb them in Rabaul. On the 20th, they spotted us, or one of their planes spotted us. There was nine Mitsubishi 97, which was called Bettys, that came out and attacked us. They got to the dropping point, and the captain of the ship had somebody with binoculars, and was supposed to let them know when they seen the bombs drop. And he swung the ship around, and it just thudded around the stern of the ship and missed the ship.
Where were you while that was going on? What were you supposed to be doing?
Well, at that point, we had launched our planes, and we were waiting for some of our planes to come back in. Like I said, we had charge of the resting gear in the after part of the ship. This is the barrier cables and cross-deck pennants that go across the ship that the planes catch with the hook of their deal and stop the planes from crashing. So we were just waiting for our planes to come back, and our planes then were chasing the first wave of nine. When they were chasing them, here come another wave of nine, and we had Lieutenant Butch O'Hara and another fellow that was in above the ship. The other fellow's guns jammed, and when they were chasing these planes away, that was a wave of nine, and he shot five of those down. We turned around and got out of there because we were up, and Rabaul was quite deep in Japanese territory at that time.
I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be you. So your job is, when these planes are going to land, to make sure that tail hook catches the cable and they don't go careening off the deck. But it's probably a pretty helpless feeling while you're waiting for those planes to come in and just watching this battle rage in the sky. I mean, could you guys see the bombers and see O'Hare and the fighters?
We could see them when they first came over and dropped the bombs. We could see them coming down. But when O'Hare and the other fellows actually chasing them, they were out of sight.
So what did you guys do while that was going on? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what you could do. You have to be pretty concerned about your ship's future here.
We probably were a little scared, really. I mean, we were up in their territory quite a bit, and here twin-engine bombers coming out after us. And like I say, we turned around and hauled out of there. It's kind of a helpless feeling when you are attacked. There's not much you can do. I mean, our duties there was in the after deck of the planes that would be landing and the resting gear. Oh, we had trained on the guns at different times and everything, but they had all those manned from the gunnery department and everything.
And it's not like you can do anything about it. You can't take cover anywhere. You've got to stay there on the deck ready to do your job, right?
That's right. There's not much you can do. And it's really a kind of a helpless feeling.
You mentioned them chasing those bombers, and they're flying F-4Fs at the time?
F-4Fs. Actually, F-4Fs was like a bumblebee. They were very short wingspan, not much in length. They had so much torque that when they would take off down the deck, they would just move sideways. The change in aviation from the planes that we had then and what got later and then even throughout later in the war, too, were just unbelievable.
Yeah, the pace of the advancement was pretty extraordinary, but so were the heroics of some of the men who flew those planes, men like Butch O'Hare. And I want to ask you a little more about his legendary day when we come back. We're also going to discuss, of course, the last moments of the USS Lexington. Gordon Scott was there on May 8th, 1942, the Battle of the Coral Sea, and he'll take us back to that fateful day when Hometown Heroes continues right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.